He was very young, younger than her son, Spark. He could hardly be 20 yet. But there was a look to him that was not young at all, something in his eyes that made her think. He has been through the fire. "My name is Lebanon of Enlad, my lady," he said, and he was about to bow or even kneel to her. She caught his hands so that they stood there face to face. "Not to me," she said, "nor I to you." He laughed in surprise and held her hands while he stared at her frankly. "How did you know I sought you? Were you coming to me when that man..." "No, no, I was running away from him, from ruffians. I was trying to go home, that's all." "To Atuan?" "Oh, no, to my farm in Middle Valley, on Gaunt, here." She laughed, too, a laugh with tears in it. The tears could be wept now, and would be wept. She let go the king's hands so that she could wipe her eyes. "Where is it, Middle Valley?" he asked. "South and east, around the headlands there. Valmath is the port." "We'll take you there," he said, with delight in being able to offer it, to do it. She smiled and wiped her eyes, nodding acceptance. "A glass of wine, some food, some rest," he said, "and a bed for your child." The ship's master, listening discreetly, gave orders. The bald sailor she remembered from what seemed a long time ago came forward. He was going to pick up Theru. Tenar stood between him and the child. She could not let him touch her. "I'll carry her," she said, her voice strained high. "There's the stairs there, Mrs. I'll do it," said the sailor. And she knew he was kind, but she could not let him touch Theru. "Let me," the young man, the king, said. And with a glance at her for permission, he knelt, gathered up the sleeping child, and carried her to the hatchway and carefully down the ladder stairs. Tenar followed. He laid her on a bunk in a tiny cabin, awkwardly, tenderly. He tucked the cloak around her. Tenar let him do so. In a larger cabin that ran across the stern of the ship, with a long window looking out over the twilit bay, he asked her to sit at the oaken table. He took a tray from the sailor boy that brought it, poured out red wine in goblets of heavy glass, offered her fruit and cakes. She tasted the wine. "It's very good, but not the dragon year," she said. He looked at her in unguarded surprise, like any boy. "From Enlad, not the Andrades," he said meekly. "It's very fine," she assured him, drinking again. She took a cake. It was shortbread, very rich, not sweet. The green and amber grapes were sweet and tart. The vivid tastes of the food and wine were like the ropes that moored the ship. They moored her to the world, to her mind again. "I was very frightened," she said, by way of apology. "I think I'll be myself again soon. Yesterday, no, today, this morning, there was a spell." It was almost impossible to say the word. She stammered at it. A curse laid on me. It took my speech and my wits, I think. And we ran from that, but we ran right to the man who..." She looked up despairingly at the young man listening to her. His grave eyes let her say what must be said. "He was one of the people who crippled the child, he and her parents. They raped her and beat her and burned her. These things happen, my lord. These things happen to children. And he keeps following her to get at her. And..." She stopped herself and drank wine, making herself taste its flavor. "And so from him I ran to you, to the haven." She looked about at the low carved beams of the cabin, the polished table, the silver tray, the thin, quiet face of the young man. His hair was dark and soft, his skin a clear bronze red. He was dressed well and plainly, with no chain or ring or outward mark of authority. But he looked the way a king should look, she thought. "I'm sorry I let the man go," he said. "But he can be found again. Who was it laid the spell on you?" "A wizard." She would not say the name. She did not want to think about all that. She wanted them all behind her. No retribution, no pursuit. Leave them to their hatreds. Put them behind her. Forget. Lebanon did not press, but he asked, "Will you be safe from these men on your farm?" "I think so. if I hadn't been so tired, so confused so confused in my mind so that I couldn't think, I wouldn't have been afraid of Handy. What could he have done? With all the people about in the street, I shouldn't have run from him. But all I could feel was her fear. She's so little. All she can do is fear him. She'll have to learn not to fear him. I have to teach her that. She was wandering. Thoughts came into her head in Kargish. Had she been talking in Kargish? He would think she was mad, an old, mad woman babbling. She glanced up at him furtively. His dark eyes were not on her. He gazed at the flame of the glass lamp that hung low over the table. A little, still, clear flame. His face was too sad for a young man's face. "You came to find him," she said, "the Archmage, Sparrowhawk." "Ged," he said, looking at her with a faint smile, "you and he and I go by our true names." "You and I, yes, but he only to you and me," he nodded. "He's in danger from envious men, men of ill will, and he has no defense now. You know that?" She could not bring herself to be plainer, but Lebanon said, "He told me that his power as a mage was gone, spent in the act that saved me and all of us. But it was hard to believe. I wanted not to believe him." "I too. But it is so. And so he..." Again she hesitated. "He wants to be alone until his hurts are healed," she said at last, cautiously. Lebanon said, "He and I were in the dark land, the dry land, together. We died together. Together we crossed the mountains there. You can come back across the mountains. There is a way." He knew it. "But the name of the mountains is Pain. The stones cut, and the cuts are long to heal." He looked down at his hands. She thought of Ged's hands, scored and gashed, clenched on their wounds, holding the cuts close, closed. Her own hand closed on the small stone in her pocket, the word she had picked up on the steep road. "Why does he hide from me?" the young man cried in grief. Then quietly, "I hoped indeed to see him. But if he doesn't wish it, that's the end of it, of course." She recognized the courtliness, the civility, the dignity of the messengers from Havnar, and appreciated it. She knew its worth. But she loved him for his grief. "Surely he'll come to you. Only give him time. He was so badly hurt, everything taken from him. But when he spoke of you, when he said your name, oh, then I saw him for a moment as he was, as he will be again, all pride." "Pride?" Lebanon repeated, as if startled. "Yes, of course, pride. Who should be proud if not he? I always thought of him as... he was so patient," Lebanon said, and then laughed at the inadequacy of his description. "Now he has no patience," she said, "and is hard on himself beyond all reason. There's nothing we can do for him, I think, except let him go his own way and find himself at the end of his tether, as they say on Gaunt." All at once, she was at the end of her own tether, so weary she felt ill. "I think I must rest now," she said. He rose at once. "Lady Tenar, you say you fled from one enemy and found another. But I came seeking a friend and found another." She smiled at his wit and kindness. "What a nice boy he is," she thought. The ship was all astir when she woke, creaking and groaning of timbers, thud of running feet overhead, rattle of canvas, sailors' shouts. Theroux was hard to waken and woke dull, perhaps feverish, though she was always so warm that Tenar found it hard to judge her fevers. Remorseful for having dragged the fragile child 15 miles on foot and for all that had happened yesterday, Tenar tried to cheer her by telling her that they were in a ship and that there was a real king on the ship, and that the little room they were in was the king's own room, that the ship was taking them home to the farm, and Auntie Lark would be waiting for them at home, and maybe Sparrowhawk would be there too. Not even that roused Theroux's interest. She was blank, inert, mute. On her small, thin arm, Tenar saw a mark, four fingers red, like a brand, as from a bruising grip. But Handy had not gripped her, he had only touched her. Tenar had told her, had promised her, that he would never touch her again. The promise had been broken. Her word meant nothing. What word meant anything against deaf violence? She bent down and kissed the marks on Theru's arm. "I wish I'd had time to finish your red dress," she said. "The king would probably like to see it. But then, I suppose people don't wear their best clothes on a ship, even kings." Theru sat on the bunk, her head bent down, and did not answer. Tenar brushed her hair. It was growing out thick at last, a silky black curtain over the burned parts of the scalp. "Are you hungry, Birdlet? You didn't have any supper last night. Maybe the king will give us breakfast. He gave me cakes and grapes last night." No response. When Tenar said it was time to leave the room, she obeyed. Up on deck, she stood with her head bent to her shoulder. She did not look up at the white sails full of the morning wind, nor at the sparkling water, nor back at Gaunt Mountain, rearing its bulk and majesty of forest, cliff, and peak into the sky. She did not look up when Lebanon spoke to her. "Theru," Tenar said softly, kneeling by her, "when a king speaks to you, you answer." She was silent. The expression of Lebanon's face as he looked at her was unreadable. A mask, perhaps, a civil mask for revulsion, shock. But his dark eyes were steady. He touched the child's arm very lightly, saying, "It must be strange for you to wake up in the middle of the sea." She would eat only a little fruit. When Tenar asked her if she wanted to go back to the cabin, she nodded. Reluctant, Tenar left her curled up in the bunk and went back up on deck. The ship was passing between the armed cliffs, towering grim walls that seemed to lean above the sails. Bowmen on guard in little forts like mud swallows' nests high on the cliffs looked down at them on deck, and the sailors yelled cheerfully up at them. "Way for the king!" they shouted. And the reply came down not much louder than the calling of swallows from the heights. "The king!" Lebanon stood at the high prow with the ship's master, and an elderly, lean, narrow-eyed man in the gray cloak of a mage of Roke Island. Ged had worn such a cloak, a clean, fine one, on the day he and she brought the ring of Erith Acby to the Tower of the Sword. An old one, stained and dirty and travel-worn, had been all his blanket on the cold stone of the tombs of Atuan, and on the dirt of the desert mountains when they had crossed those mountains together. She was thinking of that as the foam flew by the ship's sides and the high cliffs fell away behind. When the ship was out past the last reefs and had begun to swing eastward, the three men came to her. Lebanon said, "My lady, this is the master Windkey of Roke Island." The mage bowed, looking at her with praise in his keen eyes, and curiosity also. A man who liked to know which way the wind blew, she thought. "Now I needn't hope the fair weather will hold, but can count on it," she said to him. "I'm only cargo on a day like this," said the mage. "Besides, with a sailor like Master Serathen handling the ship, who needs a weather worker?" "We are so polite," she thought, "all ladies and lords and masters, all bows and compliments." She glanced at the young king. He was looking at her, smiling but reserved. She felt as she had felt in Havnor as a girl, a barbarian, uncouth among their smoothnesses. But because she was not a girl now, she was not awed, but only wondered at how men ordered their world into this dance of masks, and how easily a woman might learn to dance it. It would take them only the day, they told her, to sail to Valmouth. They would make port there by late afternoon with this fair wind in the sails. Still very weary from the long distress and strain of the day before, she was content to sit in the seat the bald sailor contrived for her, out of a straw mattress and a piece of sailcloth, and watch the waves and the gulls and see the outline of Gaunt Mountain, blue and dreamy in the noon light, changing as they skirted its steep shores only a mile or two out from land. She brought Theru up to be in the sunshine, and the child lay beside her, watching and dozing. A sailor, a very dark man, toothless, came on bare feet with soles like hooves and hideously gnarled toes, then put something down on the canvas near Theroux. "For the little girl," he said hoarsely, and went off at once, though not far off. He looked around hopefully now and then from his work to see if she liked his gift, and then pretended he had not looked around. Theroux would not touch the little cloth-wrapped packet. Tenar had to open it. It was an exquisite carving of a dolphin in bone or ivory, the length of her thumb. "It can live in your grass bag," Tenar said, "with the others, the bone people." At that, Theroux came to life enough to fetch out her grass bag and put the dolphin in it. But Tenar had to go thank the humble giver. Theroux would not look at him or speak. After a while, she asked to go back to the cabin, and Tenar left her there with the bone person, the bone animal, and the dolphin for company. "It's so easy," she thought with rage. "It's so easy for Handy to take the sunlight from her, take the ship and the king and her childhood from her, and it's so hard to give them back. A year I spent trying to give them back to her, and with one touch, he takes them and throws them away. And what good does it do him? What's his prize, his power? Is power that? An emptiness?" She joined the king and the mage at the ship's railing. The sun was well to the west now, and the ship drove through a glory of light that made her think of her dream of flying with the dragons. "Lady Tenar," the king said, "I give you no message for our friend. It seems to me that to do so is to lay a burden on you, and also to encroach upon his freedom, and I don't want to do either. I am to be crowned within the month. If it were he that held the crown, my reign would begin as my heart desires. But whether he's there or not, he brought me to my kingdom. He made me king. I will not forget it." "I know you will not forget it," she said gently. He was so intense, so serious, armored in the formality of his rank, and yet vulnerable in his honesty, the purity of his will. Her heart yearned to him. He thought he had learned pain, but he would learn it again and again all his life and forget none of it. And therefore he would not, like Handy, do the easy thing to do. "I'll bear a message willingly," she said. "It's no burden. Whether he'd hear it is up to him." The master Windkey grinned. "It always was," he said. "Whatever he did was up to him."
"You've known him a long time?"
"Even longer than you, my lady." "Taught him," said the mage, "what I could. He came to the school on Roke, you know, as a boy, with a letter from Ogeon, telling us that he had great power. But the first time I had him out in a boat to learn how to speak to the wind, you know, he raised up a waterspout. I saw then what we were in for. I thought, either he'll be drowned before he's 16, or he'll be archmage before he's 40. Or I like to think I thought it."
"Is he still archmage?" Tenar asked. The question seemed baldly ignorant, and when it was greeted by silence, she feared it had been worse than ignorant.
The mage said finally, "There is now no archmage of Roke." His tone was exceedingly cautious and precise. She dared not ask what he meant.
"I think," said the king, "that the healer of the Rune of Peace may be part of any council of this realm. Don't you think so, sir?"
After another pause, and evidently with a little struggle, the mage said, "Certainly." The king waited, but he said no more. Lebanon looked out at the bright water and spoke as if he began a tale. "When he and I came to Roke from the farthest west, born by the dragon," he paused, and the dragon's name spoke itself in Tenar's mind, "Khalesin, like a struck gong. The dragon left me there, but bore him away. The keeper of the door of the house of Roke said then, 'He has done with doing. He goes home.' And before that, on the beach of Celador, he bade me leave his staff, saying he was no mage now. So the masters of Roke took counsel to choose a new archmage. They took me among them that I might learn what it might be well for a king to know about the council of the wise, and also I was one of them to replace one of their number. Thorion, the summoner, whose art was turned against him by that great evil which my Lord Sparrowhawk found and ended. When we were there, in the dry land, between the wall and the mountains, I saw Thorion. My Lord spoke to him, telling him the way back to life across the wall. But he did not take it. He did not come back. The young man's strong, fine hands held hard to the ship's rail. He still gazed at the sea as he spoke. He was silent for a minute, and then took up his story. So I made out the number, 9, who meet to choose the new archmage. They are wise men, he said, with a glance at Tenar. Not only learned in their art, but knowledgeable men. They use their differences, as I had seen before, to make their decision strong. But this time,